It's Millie Palmer here in the 1 o'clock hour. Millie Palmer, how are you doing today?
Hey, John, I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Are you excited you don't have to weigh in on the immigration law topics in the 2 o'clock hour?
I am, but I got to tell you, I got a call earlier this week from a client of mine who's a naturalized citizen. And she asked if I wanted to keep naturalization papers as part of my file, where she should keep them as part of her file, and if we needed to do anything with the power of attorney for property in order to enable her agent to act on her behalf to prove status.
Whoa. I didn't think about that. Naturalization papers, of course, meaning that they weren't a citizen, but they've gone through the naturalization process.
Exactly.
They've sworn their oath. They've taken the test. I'm married to someone who's gone through that process, and now you have me thinking, Millie Palmer, if we need to make sure everything is in order, just kind of speaks to the situation we're in now. So if you're comfortable sharing, is it a matter of just making sure all the documents are in a place and someone has access to them if need be?
Well, I mean, that's part of it for sure. We want to make sure we can show our status, that they're here, their status is good, et cetera. And additionally, if the person is incapacitated or unable to speak for themselves, you know, that power of attorney tells us who can talk for them. Through the naturalization process, the power of attorney might not do you any good, but it on actually going in front of the immigration, the government agencies. But it would enable you to hire an attorney or a person qualified to act in that area. So that's a little bit more on your guest on the second half of the hour, and we're trying to piece it together. I might give her a call and say, hey, what should I have in my power of attorney for property in order to be able to safeguard status?
Yeah, that's an interesting conundrum. And it's something that is a pure hypothetical, and I would guess odds are that nothing's going to happen to that client. And naturalized citizens are citizens here in the United States. There's very few cases of a naturalization being withdrawn, and it's usually for extreme things like a terrorism-related situation. But hey, I guess everyone should be prepared for anything. I guess that's a broader lesson that we all should take into mind, whether we're talking about naturalized citizenship in our papers or our estate planning papers, Millie.
I guess so. And, you know, routinely we'll hold or keep a copy of birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates as part of the vital paperwork, or advise the client to keep that vital paperwork in their files. So I guess their citizenship paperwork is also part of the vital file, right?
Yep.
That makes
sense. What other calls have you been getting? Hopefully from some WGN listeners, maybe some that had called in a couple of weeks ago when we gave you the whole 2 hours, and we really dove into some interesting topics.
Oh, gosh. We really did at that time, and I appreciate the chance to chat about it. You know, I love this subject matter. I'm really passionate about helping people in this area. And, you know, I think that we get a fair amount of just sort of routine. Hey, I want to do some estate planning. In this time, what I find is in times of stress, economic stress or political stress, people sort of have a general mindset. Look, I can't control the government. I don't control Wall Street, but I could take smart steps for my family. And, you know, I wind up getting the best clients during those times of stress because they really feel the need to be proactive, to do a good job for their family. And I love that.
Interesting. So the idea of just a stressful time for a lot of people for many different reasons can be a call to action for some people. People start to look into what they've got lined up, what they don't, and say, hey, maybe it's not a distraction, but it feels like, hey, at least I'm doing something. Because when it comes to national politics, a lot of people feel like they're helpless one way or the other.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there's an old saying, I can only control what I can control, right? I'm not going to worry about the things I can't control. I'm going to worry about the things I can focus on. I can be a good steward of my resources. I can be a good planner in case I'm sick or in a pickle, or, you know, that I got the right person named to act on my behalf. So we've been getting a lot of calls from just really great people. It's been it's been a good, it's great.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's good to hear. 847-253-8800 is how people can reach you, right, Millie?
That's exactly right.
And it's Navigant Law. You have a whole team. It's not just you in the office. Tell us a little bit about what you all do there.
Gosh, we do more than estate planning. We do, we have probate services and trust administration. So sometimes we're getting calls from families saying, hey, my person just passed away or is incapacitated or is getting older, and I'm going to step up to take on more roles. And we're offering some guidance about best practices, how to make sure you don't wind up hating your sister through this whole process because she doesn't understand what you're doing. My partner Susan and her team, the lawyers that work for her, are business attorneys. So we spend a fair amount of time talking about business succession planning. If you own a business, you're hit by a bus, who's going to be able to access your bank accounts, do your payroll, take the steps needed? And if you're thinking it's your spouse, I bet you if you're hit by a bus, they're in the hospital wondering how you're doing, not worried about your payroll at your offices.
So there's a lot of different things you guys dive into. It's always, these aren't great scenarios to play out, but I think they're important ones to do so, Millie, right? Because there's so many different circumstances for when you're going to need all this stuff in order.
That's right. And, you know, everyone focuses on death and dying or disability and when they talk about this. But the reality is, with a lot of this stuff, sometimes it's just a matter of convenience. If I'm in Italy having a great vacation, I'm not dead, I'm not dying, who has the authority to act for me if something comes up, right? Something that I need somebody other than me to do stuff. So we try and, everyone runs to the bad scenario, but there's good things that we could require help during as well.
I always tell my coworkers, here's what happens if I get hit by a bus. I should just say, here's what happens if I'm vacationing in Italy and you can't reach me. That's a lot more pleasant, Millie.
It's so much nicer, right? Maybe some yacht or something on the road.
Yes.
Come on, John, let's have a little fun. Let's not always get by the bus.
I'm in a yacht somewhere, isolated, and here's what you do. 847-253-8800 is Millie's number. 312-981-7200 is ours. 773 wanted to know, Millie, can you ask if there's an easy way to go about doing this? And the following is this. My parents have both passed. My mom passed 5 years ago. And there's a $65 credit on her gas bill made out to the estate. The bank says we need to open an estate checking account in order to cash the check. But is that even worth it for $65? The money has gone to the uncollected state funds. So just wondering what would be the best way to go about that money or if it's not even worth it. And I got to say, Millie, I have experienced something like this similarly in that Treasurer Mike Frerichs has really made a point to make sure here in Illinois that money that you are owed, it's really easy to find out if you have a couple bucks, sometimes a lot more than that, that you could claim. And I got to say, like, my grandmother has a little money and others, but it is she's long past, but it is such a complicated process to get some of it. I'm sure the $65, whether that's worth it or not, is a question in the eye of the beholder. But, Millie, have you ever gotten questions like that?
We do from time to time. But, by the time you hire an attorney and do the legal work, you maybe have spent considerably more than the $65. But I can tell you there's a form called a small estate affidavit, which, those are state and county-based forms. And get it out of the statute or get it from the county office. The DMV has a variation on it, and you can fill that out. There are some tricky parts to the small estate affidavit, so I would fill it out with care if you're using it without the benefit of counsel. And that's your mechanism to say, I represent the estate. I'm going to use this money to go to beneficiaries or to pay creditors. Creditors come first, then beneficiaries. And, the beneficiaries depend on if there's a will or not. So you could pull a copy of a small estate affidavit offline. and fill it out and use that as your method to claim. Sometimes the amount is small, and by the time we spend all the time it takes to deal with the agency or the entity or to get the check and take it to a bank and try and cash it, maybe it's just not worth it.
Yeah, Millie, I feel like I could open a lemonade stand, and the amount of time that it would take to do that, I'd make $65, which is not to say that that's fair. It's just the way it is.
It's just the way it is. And trust me, John, you know, $65 is $65,
yes.
Right? And you could buy something with that, but you maybe could just let it go
yes.
and focus your somewhere else.
I often just think of it as a donation to the state, although the state can access that money and use it. It just sits in an account. I always get a little bummed out when I go to the site. It's funny, if you've never been there, I'll have to look up the website during the commercial break to make sure everyone knows it. Yeah.
It's Illinois-for-cash.
Illinois-for-cash. So it will tell me whether something's over 100 or under 100. And I often want it to be like, well, how much under 100? Because $99, I'll do a lot for. $2, I'll do nothing for. So I got to convince the treasurer to make it like under $10, under $100, so I can get a little bit more guidance on that, Millie.
That's exactly right, John. I mean, you know, there's a lot of a different attitude. And if I have multiples of out there, maybe I'm going to try and group my activities.
Yes, exactly. Okay, Millie, I'm going to put you on hold here. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. You can call it right now with estate planning questions about trusts and wills and all that stuff that we talk about here on WGN pretty frequently. You can call Millie during the week at 847-253-8800. NavigantLaw.com is the website. More after this. Let's get legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on Double. Let's get legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Millie Palmer joining us from Navigant Law. Millie, you ready to take a question?
I sure am.
All right, we're going to lock you on in, and then we'll get Judy on the line. Here, hold on, let me lock you in. Oh, good. All right, now let's get Judy on the line. Hey, Judy, what's your question?
I would like to ask if you have one sibling, not sibling, but one son or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Is it necessary to have a will, or what do you do in that situation?
Great question. Judy, this is a good question because, right, you think, I have one kid. This is so obvious. The money and everything I have is going to go to them. But, Millie, talk us through it.
Well, you really have two issues there. The first is, how does the money or things get to the child? Are you using beneficiary provisions, like naming the child as the beneficiary on your IRAs or 401ks or life insurance or bank accounts? Even on real estate, you can name a child as a beneficiary there. So you need to make sure, if that's the approach you're taking, that you're going to, that you cover everything. And I mean everything. But the next problem is, what happens if the child themselves doesn't survive you?
God forbid.
And I apologize for saying that, yeah. Or if when they survive you, they're in a bit of a pickle. What if they don't have good capacity, or they're being sued by someone, or they're in the middle of a divorce? I mean, when you're relying on naming a child through a beneficiary provision, you run the risk that they're not going to be a good beneficiary when the time arrives, right? That they themselves need help. And I guess the other real issue with using just those beneficiary provisions and nothing else is that it doesn't do you any good during your lifetime if you yourself become incapacitated or just need some help. How will they be authorized to do that?
Right. If someone were to fall ill and they needed the power of attorney, you have one kid, that doesn't mean they can walk into the hospital and make decisions for you. In fact, it means you can't do that without a power of attorney, right?
That's right. I mean, the hospital will talk to the family that's
right
there, and they don't want to get sued by the family any more than anybody else.
Right.
But ultimately, for you to have the authority to make a decision to contravene the hospital, to move someplace else, to really decide something different than what the hospital is is saying is best practices or that they have to do, refusing treatment or advancing treatment, that power of attorney is a vital document to have in place.
Okay.
So that protects my person.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Judy here if she has any follow-ups or clarifications. We can't answer them until after the news. But Judy, do you want to hang on a little longer, or were all your questions answered?
Oh, my questions were answered. Thank
you. Look at that, Millie. We helped out Judy. Ooh. Nice work.
Have a great day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Judy, have a great day. Millie, you stay here. I can't wish you a great day quite yet. Navigant Law is where you can reach Millie, navigantlaw.com, 847-253-8800. Arful, Millie, we're doing estate planning now. You ready for another question?
I am ready, John. Let's go.
Frank, you are on WGN. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question relates to the valuation of an estate in Illinois and Illinois estate taxes.
Okay.
And the basic question is, it's my understanding the estate is valued as of the date of death, but you can select an alternate valuation date, which I understand is 6 months later. Hmm. But my question is, let's say that some of the assets in the estate are stocks, and we select an alternate valuation date. But rather than waiting for that six-month period to pass, we distribute those stocks to the heirs, let's say after 1 month. It's my understanding that the date of distribution then sets the basis for those shares of stock, and that's what the estate is valued upon. Is that correct?
Well, Frank, that's a very specific question, and I hate to put Millie on the spot. She might know the answer outright. You might need to do a follow-up call. Okay. I'm just helping you out, Millie, in case you don't know the exact answer to that.
Well, I appreciate it. So the recent legislative attempts have been trying to coordinate the value used for the estate tax purpose and the value used for the resetting of the basis or the step up or possible adjustments, I guess I should say, to basis as of date of death.
So these are two different things. The government's trying to determine how much the estate is worth, and it's important to figure out through legislation which date that is to figure out if they need to collect any taxes over a certain amount, a couple million dollars. I don't know exactly what it is. But then there's also, they want to determine and legislate and figure out exactly what date the step up in basis is, meaning now this is what the estate is worth, and this is what it's worth going forward for people that take it over. Am I kind of explaining that right?
Yes. So if I have stock and I value it at date of death at $200 a share, and that's the value I use for my estate tax return for purposes of calculating how much is the total value of the estate, then if I'm distributing that same stock to a beneficiary, we have to use that same number. And so the caller, Frank, your question really is, wait a minute, we're not sure what we did on that number is matching because we're distributing before the 6 months is up.
Is that okay to distribute before the 6 months is up?
Well, typically we're not going to distribute within that quickly within date of death, because remember, our first duty is to the creditors of the estate, and that's with or without a trust. We want to make sure we're clean on creditors. But sometimes the estate is so flush with assets that we can do early distributions because we know we have enough left over or that we're not going to need it for creditor purposes. But putting that sort of thing to the side right now, I really think your question about how the valuation gets calculated is better suited to the specific accountant that's working on the matter. Mm. And I hate to kick the can over to accounting. These are things that we as legal counsel deal with all the time. But I really want, when we're digging into an actual asset and how we're doing it, I want someone from the financial side to take a look at that specific thing. So, Frank, I think your question is pretty specific. And without knowing really the ins and outs of it, I can't give you an exact answer on it.
I had a hunch that was the case, Millie. Frank, it's a great question, though.
I, yeah. I appreciate that. Is it possible to ask one quick follow-up?
Please.
Sure. On the same subject, within an estate in Illinois, if there are some assets that are joint owned, for example, a house, a savings account, one of the spouses, one of the individuals passes away, it's my understanding from reading some information on the state's attorney general website that one half of the value of those jointly held assets would be attributed to the value of the estate of the person that died. But I received some advice from, and in all fairness, it wasn't from an accountant, it was from a tax attorney,
uh-huh,
who indicated that those joint assets then get backed out, and the taxes on those wouldn't be paid until the second spouse passed away. And I haven't been able to find any information that really confirms that.
Meaning when one spouse passes away, you're wondering, do they value half the estate and then do a tax out on that? Or
right.
It, or
let's say that, as example, the house is worth $400,000. The person who passes away, their estate would reflect $200,000 in value of that asset.
Hmm. Well,
and then the other $200,000 would go to the surviving spouse. But what I was told is that $200,000 would be added in, but then it would be backed out as a marital deduction. And
right.
Let's say
it's
that when the second, yeah.
Go ahead, Millie.
It's part of the unlimited marital credit where I can leave anything. Let's say I have $100 million in assets.
Whoa.
I can leave all of that to my spouse with no estate tax repercussions. My estate doesn't get taxed a dollar from an estate tax perspective. So there's an unlimited marital deduction. So basically what we're saying is joint ownership assets, by operation of law, go to the surviving joint owner. If the surviving joint owner is a legal spouse, so we have a legal marriage, then even though it's part of the global estate, it's not subject to the estate tax at first spouse to die because of the unlimited marital.
Okay.
And that actually can be good and bad. Side note.
Wait, what would be bad about that? Don't you want everything to go to the spouse tax-free?
Well, sure, except that sometimes I want to subject things to tax at first to die, especially if I'm below the estate tax amount.
Ah.
So that second to die, I don't exceed the estate tax.
Ah, so you're playing a little game. Not a game. I mean, it's a legal game.
Well, it's a legal game that you can actually do under the tax code. So I can make something held for the benefit of my spouse, but not in joint ownership. So in that example, I would have needed to have broken the joint ownership, turn it into tenants in common, maybe his trust, her trust, or their.
My head hurts, Millie.
Each spouse's trust.
My head hurts. I think I understand what you're saying, though. I'm underneath that threshold. Let's go ahead and take the quote-unquote taxes out now to keep us under the threshold for when both of us pass, I guess you could say. My question is, what is the estate tax threshold here in Illinois? You don't have to, just a round number-ish would help.
Illinois is a $4 million amount.
Oh, okay.
Like, there are credits against assets that don't necessarily count towards that. So we can get deductions for some things. And so you really have to look at it at how do you get to the four. But four is our number here in Illinois.
So safe to say myself and a lot of other people don't have to worry about that.
Sure, except that my husband and I were just talking. When we have four kids. Every time we sent a kid to college, I made that man get a blood draw and new life insurance policy.
Huh?
I was like, oh my God, this is expensive. So we have a lot of life insurance. Most of it will disappear in the next few years because we're not as young as we once were, John. But, if we died tomorrow, we have a lot of life insurance.
And that counts as part of the estate?
Yes. That's subject to estate tax.
Really?
Unless there are tax planning things I can do with my life insurance. I can throw it in a siloed trust called an ILIC, irrevocable life insurance trust. It's an ILIT. And I could have my life insurance be in this trust. And trust, those ILITs are pesky. There's a lot of hoops you got to jump through, et cetera. But anytime I can have pieces of paper and jump through hoops and legally not pay a tax, I like that.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. And I like that you know that. And I know you used to be a tax attorney, so you're probably a little bit more privy to some of those things than maybe other estate planning lawyers out there. I got to take a commercial break. More with Millie. And Frank, thank you very much for the phone call. You spurred on a good conversation there. 847-253-8800 is how you reach Navigant Law. NavigantLaw.com. Our number, 312-981-7200. Don't keep on waiting. If you have an estate planning question, call now. Because what always happens is right when we say goodbye to Millie, 10 more people call in. So call right now. What's your question about estate planning? Were you confused about the last thing? Did it bring up something that you're now wondering if you have buttoned up? Millie can at least offer some guidance here for you from NavigantLaw.com. We're doing estate planning in this hour, law questions with Navigant Law and Millie Palmer. Millie, you doing anything fun later on this afternoon?
Well, I'm going to help my daughter make a carrot cake in about 14 minutes.
But who's counting? Okay, that sounds wonderful for Easter celebrations, I presume. Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Okay, got a great question from the 847. My wife and I have a trust, and we have it all buttoned up, at least we think. Unfortunately, we're going through a divorce. We have two kids. Does the trust just get ripped up and we start over? Does it get amended? What happens next?
Chances are it gets ripped up and you start over, and you're each going to have your own estate plan. Mid divorce, typically we want to start mid divorce by putting in new powers of attorney for health care and property. You know, the person I'm getting divorced from is probably not the one I want making medical decisions for me. Although I have to say, I have seen ex-spouses acting as agent under power of attorney, naming each other.
Yeah, the 847 says it's a very amicable one, so I mean, maybe they would still do that. But I imagine you're doing things mid-divorce because, God forbid, something could happen before the proceedings are finalized.
That's exactly right. Additionally, sometimes post-decree, and this is a little funny, where someone might say, well, I still want this asset to go to my spouse. We need to confirm that, because there's a series of Illinois laws that say if you're divorced, we're going to act like this person has predeceased you.
Hmm.
So if I want them to be a beneficiary on something, or to have a power of attorney, an agency, or to be my executor or my trustee, maybe I need to reaffirm that even though we're divorcing, I want them in charge. And they're going to hold things for our joint children or whatever that may be, right?
So if you yell at your ex-husband, you're dead to me, the state agrees?
Turn the picture to the wall. You're dead to me. You know, you really have to be a little further along. But I see it a lot in some of the Facebook groups I belong to, where someone is starting a divorce and they really want to know what's the first step. And obviously, you have the first step with the divorce attorney, but my first step is new powers of attorney.
Interesting.
Maybe a new will and testament.
Yep. 708 has an interesting question. They've received a pretty large inheritance in the form of a sum of money. I have obviously financial questions of what to do with it. Are there any legal ramifications? Should I be considering where I put that in my estate? Is that my money only? Does my wife get access to that? A lot of questions this person has. Maybe talk a little bit about that process, Millie.
Oh, sure. So Illinois has a statute that says inherited wealth, if it's kept segregated from marital property, then if you later divorce from your spouse, they can't touch the inherited wealth. So there's a lot in there. Number one, we can never commingle it. We never put that into a joint account.
Uh-huh.
We put it into our own accounts. Number two, we want to make sure that that money, we know where it goes. So, for example, my great aunt Agnes dies and leaves me a family lake house in northern Wisconsin. Maybe I only want that to stay in the family, to go to my children, not to my spouse, right? So we look at things like that. How do we feel about that inherited wealth? Does it have a legacy associated with it, or is it just a sum of money? Additionally, in divorce, a judge cannot give away my segregated inherited wealth. I kept it alone. It's in my account only, never commingled. But they can consider that in the divorce as an asset available to me for purposes of my maintenance and care, and maybe give me less of the marital assets or more of the marital debt.
I see. So when you say maintenance, just so people know, that's the old term for, or the new term for alimony, right?
That's right. And so sometimes it's called separate maintenance. Sometimes it's called alimony, you know, whatever that happens to be. Or I could be assigned more marital debt. I could be told, hey, you pay the credit card bills. You've got that big pot of money over there. So I could be seen as in a better financial position when the judge is splitting up assets. So, you know, it's a complex issue, and we have to ask first, what are our feelings about the asset itself? What's the strength of the marriage now? Let's guess, what's the likely strength of the marriage in the future? Boy, John, I'm stumbling with words, too.
That's okay. It's been a long week for everybody. I got another question on the text line, Millie, I want to get to before we let you go to the carrot cake. What if you're not married anymore? You have two kids. One of the kids has kind of separated themselves from the family via email, via actions for over 13 years. What do you do to protect the other kid that's still there and who's actively involved in the family? I don't know if this person's asking, like, can you just make sure that one kid gets everything and not this other one who has separated themselves from the family?
Well, if you're going to do that, you really need to be intentional in your actions. Your will and your trust should state, despite my love and affection or whatever, however you feel, you know, for the child, I do not intend to provide for them, or I do not intend to make an equal distribution. If that's the case, let's recognize it. Let's not make it assumed to be an overlook. The last thing we want to do is to saddle the kid who's stuck by us with a lawsuit in the end, because the child who left the family arrangement is coming back looking for a share. I mean, obviously the best thing is for everyone to reconcile. You know, I'm a live and let live, let's all get along together type of gal.
I can tell.
Lots of families have estrangements, lots and lots of them, for a variety of reasons. And, you know, we want to make sure that the people who stick by us are taken care of and not penalized for doing so.
Yeah. Millie, we're getting some other questions on the text line. While you're making carrot cake, I might text a few of them and then text your answers back to the texter. That's what I do. I go above and beyond for our texters because we are out of time, unfortunately. People can call you during the week, 847-253-8800. Got about a minute till our break. What's the elevator pitch, Millie? Why am I calling you and Navigant Law through this decision?
Well, you know, John, I'm not a big-time sales girl, but I love what I do. I love that I help people. I love that I work hard to make sure they understand their choices. And that's my whole firm. That's our culture. We're really out there trying to make a difference for the people that hire us. So I hope people that resonates with your people and that they'll choose Navigant. But in the meantime, you have a great weekend and enjoy that baby.
Oh, thank you very much, Millie. I appreciate that. Enjoy the carrot cake and your Easter Sunday. Take care, and we'll talk soon, okay?
All right, John. Talk to you soon. Bye now.
That's great, Millie Palmer, who is so kind, based out of Arlington Heights, by the way. Her number again, 847-253-8800, NavigantLaw.com, 847-253-8800. Just a really approachable person with some really complicated conversations to have, and kind of want her by my side through those conversations. I bet you would too.